This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is December 13th, 1994, and I'm in my office in the Red Gym with Carl Kasel. And Carl will be leaving after this semester to take a post at the University of Chicago, so I guess you could call this an exit interview. Carl, why don't we just talk about, briefly, about your childhood, your early years of schooling, where you were raised, your early attitudes toward education.
I was born and raised in Schenectady, New York, in a little suburb of Schenectady across the Mohawk River from it called Scotia, which means Scotland. It was actually founded by a guy named Glenn Saunders. Schenectady is the home of General Electric Company. My dad, who was an expatriate Tennessee Southerner, expatriate in the sense that he took to Northern culture better, was a General Electric engineer all of his career, all of it spent in Schenectady, and my mother had been born and raised in Schenectady. So despite my name, my deepest ethnic identity is all French Catholic. My mother was French Catholic, 100%. People that came through Canada, Quebec, down into Schenectady, Troy, Albany to work in the mills. So I knew picnics entirely French-speaking with hundreds of first cousins drinking beer and slapping each other on the back. And so that, in terms of deep embedded ethnicity, that's what I knew. My mother's family from Schenectady, all French. As they say, my dad was an engineer. You had asked whether there were influences on my later choice of career. My mom was a teacher in schools, and then, as was common in those days, quit work after she had children. Not when she got married, but after she had children. But remained active, kind of a rally round the flag boys volunteer type person in lots of activities, especially around issues of public education. But I hadn't imagined I would get involved in public education when I was in high school. I thought I wanted to be a doctor, probably for some pretty vague and inappropriate reasons. Like I fancied that it was an altruistic thing to do, and if you were smart, that would be a good thing to do for society, become a doctor. I don't know. Maybe secretly, I thought you also earn a lot of dough. And I wasn't really very good at science. I was going to go to college and be an English major and then go to medical school. So I think even then I knew I gravitated toward the humanities. So I did that. I went to Yale University and I majored in English with a view toward going to medical school. And there was a brief time when medical schools were saying, certainly we want people who are humanities majors as much as biology majors. So I took the requisite college chemistry and college biology. I made it through 2 years of trying the introductory courses and then just realized I wasn't very good at science and didn't actually like it very much. So there I was, an English major. And at that point, it may have been that all this boyhood sitting around the table drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and talking about public education until late at night had some influence on me, because I decided I wanted to become something in public education, which is a far cry from wanting to become a doctor.
It's a far cry, yes.
Especially at an Ivy League institution like Yale, which had, I don't know how many years before, but sometime in the 1950s, and I was there from 58 to 62. Sometime in the 1950s, their president abolished their school of education, and the most famous one-liner about it was, he said, "There's no such thing as pedagogy." It's only subject matter.
Who was that? Who said that?
A. Whitney Griswold was his name, one of these great old patrician people, and they actually sent their professors packing in the streets from the ed school at Yale. So, I don't think I can reconstruct exactly how I decided to do this, but I think it had something to do with just always having been interested in public schooling. When I was an undergraduate at Yale, despite the fact that I got good grades, I don't think I could ever conceive of being a professor. A professor was just something that was totally other than me. I hadn't thought about it. It wasn't a role that I thought I could or would play. And so I thought, gee, you know, it really would really be fun to be a good teacher in a public school and then become something like a school principal or superintendent of schools, I guess was my kind of design. It was at the end of the line and all this. So I thought the way you do it is to go to an MAT program. That was the big plan then for getting kids with BAs who hadn't done teacher training to get master's degrees and go into classrooms. And Yale had a very good one. That was the one thing they created after they abolished their school of education, which was to have some Yale graduates and other liberal arts college graduates come to their MAT program. And They were very, very strong in the ALMAT about wanting career teachers. They didn't want any of this nonsense about becoming administrators. So I went and interviewed with them, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and they said, get out of here. Go to Harvard. Harvard's where these hypocrites go who teach for a little bit and then go into, you know, and go back to graduate school and get some kind of an EDD and become a school superintendent and get called doctor the rest of their lives. So that was a pretty clear message. And so I went to Harvard. But I want to go back, loop back. There was one guy at Yale. It was the only education course I ever found. It may have been the only education course left in the place outside of the MAT program, which we couldn't do as undergraduates. There was a man in the psychology department named Claude Buxton. Bless him. Still around, I think. At least I met him 10 years ago, after 10 years after he retired. Buxton was chairman of the psychology department at Yale, so he's a well-regarded scholar administrator, and he wrote some stuff. I don't know if he was a great powerhouse. He actually wrote a book on good teaching at the college level, which is pretty unusual.
Yeah.
It's kind of a warm, humanistic book about common sense things about what college teachers ought to think about. Probably nobody ever read it, you know, because why would a college teacher need to read about teaching? So he offered a seminar in education, and it was kind of a watering hole for people interested in public education at Yale. Almost nobody was, and he let you, because he knew it was about the only course around for undergraduates on education, he didn't care if you did psychology or philosophy or whatever. So I wrote my term paper in there on theories about democracy and education, on the Reconstructionist educators and stuff like that. So that was the one little ray there. I think I got a wonderful education at Yale. I English major was one of the best majors. It was one of the top departments in the country, and it basically was a way to learn how to write.
Was it a pretty generalist type of undergraduate training in English, or did you have a specialty?
It was very old-fashioned and very rigorous. We had general exams, so you know, you quaked in your boots and you studied during spring vacation of your senior year, and you went and sat for 8 hours of exams, and you had to know everything from Chaucer to Eliot. It was very English. The undergraduate major allowed you to substitute one course and no more on American literature and one course and no more on European literature and translation. All the rest had to be English. We mean English.
So we're talking Chaucer, Milton, Shakespeare.
Yeah, we did it all. Spencer and
Spencer.
So all the minor poets. I like prose a lot, and I at that time when I thought about history, which I couldn't figure out what history was all about. It's strange. Since I became a historian later on, I couldn't get what it was beyond storytelling, narrative. You know, I just hadn't had good training in history in high school, and the few courses I took at Yale, I did it as a way to get around taking history. I took history of music to satisfy my history requirement, and that really was musical analysis dressed up as a history course, which was a great shock to those who couldn't do the musical analysis. And then finally in senior year, I thought, this is enough. It's too big a discipline, history, not to take some real history course, so I took a course in European intellectual history, and I didn't do well in it. I thought it was difficult. But what I couldn't fathom was why anybody would want to be going around reading all these big, fat, thick history books that seemed to me just loaded with facts when I was out there reading, you know, Eliot novels, poetry, and so forth. So I had a grand time. I love the analytical parts of the English major, and I love reading this stuff. And Yale was at the height of what was called the New Criticism, which was, it's now in much disrepute, but at the time, it was very flattering for an undergraduate because they said, you're the critic, don't read any other critics, don't read about the historical context of the work. The work exists, you exist, interpret it. So we did, and we wrote a tremendous amount, and it was good training in, mostly in writing. So I liked that part of it a lot, and Yale was good at singing, and so I did a lot of that.
Well, you were in the
male
Whiffenpoof.
I was in the Whiffenpoof. And I made a lot of good friends there. One of the nice things about the Yale singing tradition, if you're in one of these small groups, is it was a much healthier substitute for the infamous senior finishing societies, you know, the underground senior societies at Yale, which that wasn't my milieu at all. I didn't do those. But Yale singing at least had some purpose, and it entertained people, and songs were goofy, but...
We're poor little lambs
who have lost our way.
Ba-ba-ba.
Well, all those ba-ba-ba folks have been friends, and it's nice in academic life, as I suppose it is if you're in business to just have very close friends who are in some utterly different occupation mm-hmm. and live in different parts of the mm-hmm. country. So that was a bonding experience of me and a dozen people, four or five of whom I see quite regularly mm-hmm. now. An architect sculptor in Washington and a choral director at Washington University in St. Louis. And so it's been a lot of fun to have those friends. I went to the MAT program at Harvard in English to get a Master of Arts in Teaching in English, and I got into a program that was really good. In senior year at Yale, I applied to the Harvard MAT program, and they said, would you like to apply for an experimental version of the MAT, all of which was internship anyway. In practice teaching is usually divided between, I guess, what they just call practice teaching and what they call internship. Internship being the more expensive version where you have your own classes for an entire semester and you are the teacher and then you get critiqued by people visiting, but you're not just taking over a set 8 weeks from another senior teacher. So they wanted to try a full year internship. They said, now look, you're going to have to go 2 years for the same degree, but if you do it, you'll start right out with a homeroom and a full schedule at 4/5 pay, the other fifth we robbed from your salary to pay your advisors, which were, the nice thing was it was elaborate supervision. It was really good. So my students looked on me as a real teacher. The other come on was the Plan C, as they called it, this new experimental one, which only admitted, maybe 10 or a dozen students a year, only existed in four places: Newton High School, Scarsdale High School, two of the premier suburban kind of public schools, and Andover and Deerfield. Leave it to Harvard to have a balance between private elite schools and public schools, and the public schools were elite enough as it was. So I said, Newton, you mean I can apply to this thing and specify Newton? He said, yep. So I thought that was a really good deal, and I didn't care. I thought my life was going to be long enough, so it didn't matter 2 years or one. So I went immediately from Yale into the classroom in Newton with only a week's workshop, basically centered around the idea of how difficult it was to do even one lesson plan, and that we were about to get immersed in doing four classes worth of lesson plans four times a week. Newton had a wonderful English department, and we didn't have as many classes with each class every week as others, because we were supposed to be doing so much writing training. So anyway, that was a really good experience. People visited my classes a lot. They were really smart and really, really skilled at what they did. It was the best expensive kind of teacher training, and it doesn't exist anymore. Whether it made me a good teacher or not is another matter.
Did you enjoy the teaching?
I did. I found, like a lot of beginning English teachers do, that you come out of college and you think, I'm going to have all these kids write a tremendous amount. And even though we had light schedules at Newton, a light schedule was four classes four times a week, but four classes was 150, 160 kids. Is that right?
No. One theme a week.
Whatever. And you go in there as a BA out of a liberal arts college, and you say, oh, I want them to write a couple of times a week. So by Christmas time, all of our apartments were just like oceans, mountains of white paper that was ungraded and unevaluated. And three of the four of us got sick in the process. And finally, our supervisors tried to rescue us. And a couple of us got viral pneumonia. And all that stuff. So it was a pretty hardworking year, I think it was very good teacher training. I never followed it up and became a classroom teacher of English in the high school. The second year, we went back to campus and took courses, some at MIT. I took linguistics with the famous Noam Chomsky.
Oh, yeah.
And
is he a good teacher?
He's a wonderful teacher, fabulous teacher, and his politics are completely outside of his classroom because the formal kind of linguistics he does doesn't lend itself to social messages, mm-hmm. really. And it's controversial in its own way, but not in a political way. So he actually was quite careful not to use political examples when he would use sentences of examples on the board. He was very welcoming to public school teachers who hadn't had all the prerequisites, so he let us into his advanced courses and then let us just kind of guess what it was about, and he was generous. He kind of gave everybody a B that was smart enough to last the course and finish it up. So I took a lot of good stuff that year and substituted at the high school to pay my rent. Mm-hmm. I got married at the end of that year, and the end of that second year in the MAT. In January of that year, I got a call from the TA in my English methods course who said, let's go out for coffee, and I did. And he said, would you like to become principal at the American School of Warsaw? Because he knew I was interested in becoming an English teacher, and then eventually in my career thinking about school administration. So this certainly short-circuited the part where you were supposed to become the good teacher. But it was pretty fascinating, and he just knew well the person who currently held this job, the American School in Warsaw, Poland. And that guy had written him, said, George, do you want to come over here and take my place? There was no notion of a search or, you know, posting this thing at all. They just asked the current principal to find another one. And I fit, to some degree, what the previous guy had been. He just happened to have come out of the Harvard MAT program. Although he was a private school guy, and that pleased the people in the Foreign Service, but I was kind of this unwashed guy from Scotia Glenville Public High School. But by the time they heard Yale BA in English Literature and Harvard MAT in the teaching of English, I sounded pretty much like Tony Marwell, the WASPy guy who had just been there, and his friend recommended me. So I wrote them a letter about my ideas about education and so forth, and they hired me. And about that time, I proposed marriage to the woman I was dating, and it was all a package. It was kind of like, will you marry me? And if you'll marry me, will you go to Warsaw, Poland for 2 years?
Now, you had no language training or anything like that?
No, a lot of people thought maybe I went because I was Polish or something. They would think, well, how the heck did you wind up in Warsaw, Poland? But it was just a fluke. I had no interest in Poland particularly, but I had a real interest in school administration. Yeah. So they said you'd get a chance to teach fourth grade. At that time, the principal taught full-time. You know, it reminded me later on when I became a historian of education, I realized that the word principal came from the phrase principal teacher.
Right.
It was the adjective. And then principals became the principal teacher, and they supervised, usually they were men, and they supervised female assistants. And eventually they stopped teaching. And my little school in Warsaw recapitulated exactly that process. When I went, the principal was doing all the administration outside of a regular full classroom day. And he was teaching fourth grade. And that was the deal when I went there. And I realized, gee, with 120 kids in the school, and a first through sixth grade was becoming a K through eight, and we were doing hiring, and we were doing a sister program with Lexington Schools in Massachusetts, and I thought, we can't have the principal teach full-time, but it's wonderful to have the principal teach. Mm-hmm. So I put it to half-time, and within two principals later, it was the usual American pattern. The principal didn't teach at all. They had a big new building and four times as many students, and the principal was doing what most principals do. So I taught half-time the second year, and we went through a big reform that I had learned about at Harvard. As soon as I got this job at Harvard in the MAT program, just to loop back again for a minute, I quickly changed my schedule. Luckily, I got the job before the second semester started. So I changed my whole schedule, and I took Introduction to Elementary Education, and I didn't take anything about administration at all, but it's all about curriculum developments. I took a course from a guy named Robert Anderson, who along with John Goodlad was the author of a book called The Non-Graded Elementary mm-hmm. School. And the first thing I did when I got to Warsaw, which was a change, you had a lot of latitude to do things there. I mean, you need to keep your staff on board and hopefully making decisions together. But the school board was very cooperative the first year I was there. There was a man who was the head of it named Bill Donnelly, who was the chief agricultural officer, and I soon found out a CIA agent. Didn't particularly bother me. He was a wonderful democratic guy as far as the school board was concerned. I don't know what he was doing with his CIA stuff, but he was chairman of the school board, and when I got there, and I said, you know, Bill, I want to wait and see about the structure of the school and reforms and so forth would require the faculty to, you know, really debate things. But I don't think I can be principal of a school that gives A's, B's, and C's letter grades to kids that are 8 years old. I just don't believe in it. He said, fine, change it. So
we just
abolished the grade system, the graded report card system. I announced my intention. I didn't think it was a good thing, and I said, come on, let's talk about it. Here's what I propose. And so the faculty bought into it. After all, I was the new principal. And I proposed forward-looking as well as retrospective, entirely narrative accounts of what they did in each area. So language arts at the end of a semester would be a bunch of discussions about how well the kid wrote and things that they needed particularly to work on and some areas that they weren't doing as well on as we might expect for this level, but all verbal, none of it quantified in any way. No attempt to take all these kids from all these different countries and try and cram them into some standard. We had, as a check against all that subjectivity, Stanford achievement tests. We gave once a year. And so if the parents were all nervous, we could say, well, you want numbers here, we have numbers. Mm-hmm. You can have these scores. And if you have to take them back to the United States or take them back to England or Italy, or here's some scores. And once in a while I had parents who just rebelled. I can remember one day when American parents said, I didn't mind your narratives when I was here, but I can't bring this back to Washington, D.C. and show this to the public schools. They want to know if she got an A in penmanship. So I just got out one of Tony Marlowe's old report cards and just filled it in for the kid. Gave her a B in something to make it look plausible, you know. Said, here's a report card. You want a report card? So we did these narratives, and the idea of the narrative was that it forced the teachers, it encouraged the teachers to think about what would be going on next semester with that kid on all these different subjects in language arts and math. I think the teachers quite liked it. It does show you the strengths and weaknesses of your teachers, because a poor teacher doesn't do well on that kind of an exercise. They tend to get pussy and blame the kids and say inappropriate things sometimes. And so I got involved in a little bit of dilemma about, you created the system, Kaisel, are you going to intervene with these teachers and tell them that you don't think they're writing very good reports? But on balance, it's an awful lot better than hiding behind A's and B's and C's. So the second year, we made it into a non-graded elementary school. And that was fun. You mentioned when we talked about what to talk about before, what did this teach me about schools and reform? Yeah. It's a very untypical school. I had all this latitude to reform. I had a very bright, dedicated bunch of teachers who weren't paid very much. Most of them were in Poland because they loved Poland for some reason. They started out as graduate students studying Polish culture and just fell in love with the place and stayed, or something like that. So they were not highly trained in elementary school stuff, but we were doing our best to find out about the new science and the new math. And we moved to having an English as a second language program from having had none. And the school was growing and all that kind of stuff.
The amount of reform that you did in a couple of years sounds, by American standards, absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, we really changed.
2 decades of work in America.
The change to an ungraded elementary school was a big one. And then during the second year, since I was going to leave, the big thing we created was the joint program with Lexington Schools. So then we were connected not only to Bob Anderson, who took an interest because he had spawned this young student who went abroad to Warsaw and created a non-graded elementary school. So he thought that was pretty neat. So he came over and critiqued it for us. And he didn't pull any punches either. He and I got along well, and he obviously was flattering to him that I had done this. And I was flattered to have the father of the non-graded elementary school come and critique our program. The parents thought that was, good and important. And he said, look, you don't want to get too carried away with homogeneous grouping. One of the good things about the non-graded elementary school, especially in a school abroad, where I remember an Israeli kid came in who makes the point, Ahuva Livne. She comes in with her parents. She doesn't speak very much English, but she's bright as she can be. She's 10. Should she be in the fourth grade? That's what they used to do. They say, you're 10, you're in the fourth grade. Turns out that if you try and figure out what her abilities are, her math abilities are at the 11th grade, and her reading abilities are at the second grade. So why should she be in the fourth grade? Everything's going to be wrong for her. So having a non-graded elementary school meant that we could put her in the appropriate group for language arts and another group for mathematics and another group for social studies. And they thought we had it homogeneously grouped too much and that we were putting too much emphasis on it, and there were flaws in too much homogeneous grouping. And so we talked about planning in the future. Of course, I was only there for 2 years. We talked about planning so that social studies and science would be more by age than by grouping, and that teachers would be left to their own devices to find reading materials that were appropriate for kids at different levels. But that you could study the kind of things we studied in social studies. There would be great religions of the world, a lot of international stuff. And I remember lessons in which I tried to just find materials that were appropriate for different kids. And then we were homogeneously grouped in foreign languages. The main foreign language at that time was French. And language arts and math, which people persist in thinking of as pretty hierarchical. So that was the reform and the Lexington thing. Lexington then helped them recruit more professionally in the future. And when I left, the non-graded thing lasted for about 3 or 4 principals. And then somebody came along and said, what? No grades. Nonsense. And so I did a lot of change. And I think that once you put the structure on the wall and you say, this is the way we do things at the Warsaw Elementary School, the American School of Warsaw, and it's got all these periods and the language arts are separate and have different groupings and the math is different and has different groupings. And if I'll figure this very intricate schedule out, some principals just came in and said, oh, all right, if that's the way you do it, it's news to me. But my immediate successor, I think, believed in it, a guy named David Rivers, who later became principal of the middle school at the Lab School at Chicago.
Oh.
He went from Warsaw to that.
Is he still in Chicago?
No, and I don't know where he went. I didn't follow him after that. Of course, I didn't know him very well because I didn't overlap with him.
Well, how did you end up back in, what happened when you left the school?
Okay, so the second year I decided this was all well and good, but I didn't really want to become a school administrator. I mean, I've sounded as if it was wonderful, but I wasn't well suited to it. I had thought, the lesson I learned, not about school reform, which we did a lot of, but the lesson I learned about school administration was that it wasn't what I had thought it was. Mm-hmm. I had thought, as I've later kidded with people, that I thought that a school principal was a philosopher on wheels. And it turns out that's not really the case. As the principal of that school, I had no superintendent. I was really, at way too young an age, playing the role that a superintendent does. It was a tiny little school, but nonetheless, I reported to the Board of Education. And I did the hiring and all this stuff. So I was performing all those roles that are in a larger system are played both by a superintendent and then by principals. And I found that what you needed to be best at was politics of education and good personnel work. You needed to know how to hire people and how to get them to work on your team. And I wasn't particularly good at it. At least I didn't think so. I certainly didn't enjoy it much. Basically, if there was a negative decision to be made, and I had a few of them, I had a few Lulus, like firing a teacher, I would bring that home. If nine people told me I was doing a great job and one people thought I was really lousy, it was that person I brought home. So I thought, I don't think I want to buy into this for the rest of my life. And I got quite stressed the second year, maybe because the pace of the change was too much or I was too young for the job or something like that. The people from Lexington were a great help, and they came over and they did comment in a report on me that there was a lot of stress on me, that I was an awful young person to be playing this role of being responsible to the board and so forth. But that ambivalence, combined with what I found when I looked into administration programs at that point, what you do to learn to become a school administrator in a doctoral program, discouraged me from doing it, because the programs were all into systems management and what I consider to be the managerial side of things. Even the Harvard Ed School, they talk about leadership, but what you study is, it seemed to me, was managerial. So I... Now we're almost to get to the part of this narrative that gets me into the history of education. Mm-hmm. I just started doing some reading in the field of education. What I knew was that I wanted to stay in education.
In Poland.
In the spring of the, in the winter of my second year, I the school board had asked me to stay on, even though I had some considerable conflict with the second year chair, who wasn't as flexible and didn't see eye to eye with me on a lot of things. And that put some stress on me. Nonetheless, the board asked me would I stay sign on for two more. Well, I didn't want to do that. I thought that just delays my deciding what I want to do for graduate school and the rest of my career. And also, I had a deal with my wife that we would go for 2 years and then she would go back to school, where she was in a 5-year nursing program and hadn't finished the fifth year. So she had delayed her education for me to do this thing, and we had a pretty firm deal. We would go back, not just to the States, but to New York City, mm-hmm. where she could finish her 5-year nursing degree at Columbia. So off we went, but I figured I'm going to be in New York and I need to think up what I'm going to do. I can either apply to teach school in the New York City area, and I did some of that. I did some inquiring around about whether I could get jobs teaching. And since we had saved up a little money, I thought about graduate programs, and I read some stuff just with a view toward reading some philosophy, some sociology, some history. History was not a discipline that I necessarily thought was anything that would be relevant to me. And among the books I read was Lawrence Kremen's The Transformation of the School. Mm-hmm. And one book set me on my career.
Really?
What
do you think, what was it about that book that had such a profound effect on you?
Well, first of all, I guess I didn't have any idea what the history of education was like, but if you'd asked me, I would have thought, gee, it's probably the worst of what I thought about history in as an undergraduate, which is just a bunch of facts, you know, and what's the boot is probably about boring stuff. It's about the history of schools, and I'm interested in schools, but I couldn't possibly be interested in the history of schools. So I read this book, and it was gracefully and delightfully written, and it was about concepts and ideas, and it was written with confidence and hooked things up to, you know, other currents in American life. I don't know, I just liked it, mm-hmm. just enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So... I had known Ted Sizer at the Harvard Ed School, who is incidentally a historian of education, although I hadn't cared about that when I was in the MAT program because I was in English and so forth, but he had been the dean when I was there, so I knew him. I wrote to him about what I thought I might want to do in graduate school, inspired by Kremen's book, I dreamed up some project which I never pursued, but it was my entree to writing these people. I thought I was real interested in it, and that was, how did it come to be that schools of education got so isolated from the main curriculum, the letters and science faculty at the different universities? Sounds like a naive question, but I thought I was interested in that. So I wrote these folks, and they said, excuse me, it sounds like you're interested in doing the history of education. And because I had written Sizer at Harvard, whom I knew, and Kremen in New York, whom I didn't know, and got a very engaging, wonderful letter back from Kremen, you know, he received this weird letter from this oddball English major from Yale, principal of school in Warsaw. So he wrote, essentially said, come on along, and he knew Sizer, and they cooked up a joint program between Teachers College and Harvard, that where I would start at Teachers College and study for a year with Kremen, and then I would go
this
on
was done
up
done for you.
Yeah. Well, Kremen had had the idea for a while, and I just came along at the right time. And I did do that. I stayed for at Teachers College for a year with the advanced plan that I would go to Harvard. The idea was to study with Bernard Balin, who was in the history department. Sizer was the dean, and he was busy being the dean, and I really wanted to study with Balin anyway. I thought he was the intellectual powerhouse in the field at the time and all that stuff. And so I had to essentially go up and try out for Balin, you know. I had to give him a paper that I'd done in Kremen's seminar to show that I could really do history. Which by that time, I had learned enough from Kremen, who was a good teacher and ran a good seminar. And so I gave this paper to Bernard Balin. So that brick in the Temple of Scholarship, nobody ever noticed. I started out to figure out the influence of Francis Bacon, and then I found out there wasn't any. So Balin was kind of amused. It's really hard to write a paper about negative findings in history. We usually like to have positive findings. So I gave him that paper, and he said, okay, you seem okay, come along. My further misgivings were that Lawrence Kremen, at that time, had a group of students gathered around him. He had an almost European-style seminar where you stayed in it the whole time you studied with him. And so as a first-year graduate student, not only first time in graduate school, but first time doing history, I was in this family-like seminar with people that adored him and were at different stages of their graduate career. Mm-hmm. So some people would be doing the first history paper they ever did for a presentation. Some people would be doing chapter 9 of their dissertation. And they were from, we didn't actually feel threatened by it, if that's what you were thinking. And it just worked out wonderfully well. I think he probably used different expectations for different folks. And they were from the graduate faculty at Columbia and Teachers College, so he had had enough powerful success in his history writing, so he had bridged that wide gap between the Teachers College, which is anybody using this tape, if anyone ever does, should know the Teachers College is not an undergraduate institution for teacher training. It is the Graduate School of Education of Columbia University. So I liked it a lot, and I thought, should I really do this thing that they want me to do, going up to Harvard, which is a real snobbish, tough place? I've been there, I know that. And everybody likes Kremen. I mean, how many graduate students are there in the country that are happy? Yeah. And all of his students seem to like this place a great deal. So I had some doubts, but I got a fellowship to Harvard, which helped. A full fellowship, 4 years of support, which envisioned that I would work for I guess it was 5 years of support. You had to work for two of them, and the rest of it was free. And Balin accepted me, so I went on up there, and I liked Cambridge and the area, and I thought Balin was a powerhouse. So I did my PhD in the history of education at Harvard, participating both in the history department as a tutor, job that Balin got for me, which is a much coveted position, but is given out by powerful professors to whomever they please. So he just got me this job. It was wonderful fun. I was a TA of Harvard History Department undergraduates, a tutor as they call it, so I had 8 students total for the year. And you were just expected to really meet with them one-on-one, sometimes in groups. It was the year of the Cambodian invasion. Everything broke apart. Yeah. Students disappeared, and all these new rules came in about what you would do about trying to grade students that, you know, that didn't exist any longer and all that stuff. But until that late spring of that year, it was really a wonderful experience.
So
and
was Balin your more or less your mentor at?
Yeah,
so you really had two in a sense.
That's right. I considered Kremen and Balin my mentors, and that's the way they intended it. Because these were the Vietnam War years, I was in graduate school 66 to 70, so I arrived at Harvard. The Harvard part of it was which was supposed to be the, you know, after the first year, and I was supposed to finish at Harvard. I arrived there in the fall of 67, by which time the Vietnam War was really hot. Yeah. And my wife and I have been involved in anti-war activities on the kind of liberal side. We were always the ones who said, yes, bring the baby in the canvas backpack and put a coat and tie on to be a marshal of the parade so that the yippies won't look like they ruled the whole thing, you know, and the people who throw bricks at bank windows. So we were part of the liberal anti-war movement, and it was very, very preoccupying. It's kind of hard to go back and remember how we managed to get the intellectual work done.
Yeah, people have to almost have lived through that to understand what an experience it was.
It is. There were these bull sessions, you know, graduate school bull sessions where you just sat up till 3 o'clock in the morning agonizing and gnashing your teeth, you know, with people that were in graduate school. One of my closest friends in graduate school was Chuck Reed, who's now the acting dean of the graduate school here and long time now associate dean of the graduate school. He and I were old friends and just happened to both get jobs at Wisconsin at the same time. But we saw a lot of them, and you just... it was really hard to get started in the morning and just not think about all this stuff that was going on. But we did. We managed to do it. And so I finished in 70 and came out here.
Had Balin written Education in the Forming of American Society yet?
Yeah, he had. And by that time, he'd kind of moved out of the field.
Oh, he had. He was a colonial historian.
He's a colonial historian. And by the time I knew him, he'd won the Pulitzer Prize for a book on the American Revolution. So he was fully back into political history, and he had a book called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution that won the Pulitzer Prize. And I guess that, let's see, I went there in 67, I forget when the Education in the Forming of American Society, I forgot when it was really, early 60s.
That was a very
so he was a big name, and he was still attracting some students who wanted to do history of education. He had had Jürgen Herbst, David Tyack had studied with him. Jonathan Messerly, the biographer of Horace Mann, had studied with him, a few others. But I think I must have been one of the last, because then he increasingly got this reputation as a person in colonial American history and not particularly interested in education.
How healthy was the field of history and of education when you left Harvard?
Well, there were two things going on. One, the side that I had studied on, not through any ideological preference of mine, but just because I love Kremen's book, and I started with him, and then he said, well, gee, why don't you go up to Harvard and study with Balin? They were the two that broke this first revision open about the history of schooling should not be a defensive sort of celebration of public schooling. It should be a look at what schooling really was, what education really was in previous societies. But their main point was not ideological so much as opening up the subject matter of education to education beyond schools, you know, the family and churches and newspapers and all that stuff. It was natural for Balin because he was a colonial historian, and it was natural for Kremen at that time because he was beginning his big three-volume history of American education. And so he was studying the colonial period, and in the colonial period, the schooling was a small part of education. So that made a lot of sense. But at the same time, and not involving me very much, was what we've come to call radical revisionism, which was very much of a reversal of normative judgment and was focused on public schools, but it was all about how they were so conservative and racist and bureaucratic. So Michael Katz had just finished his work at the Harvard Ed School, although I didn't know him, but he'd finished in 68, just sort of finished up when I was arriving. I read that book late in the development of my own dissertation.
What was the name of the book again?
The Irony of Early School Reform was, but I don't know if the dissertation was called that, but that's what the book was finally called. And Marvin Lazarson, who became known as one of the revisionists, was at the Harvard History Department when I was in my program. I don't know that my dissertation work was directly influenced by these people so much as maybe David Tyack and some of his work on bureaucracy.
And just briefly, what was your dissertation topic?
The dissertation topic was the development of New York City's schools from 1750 to 1850. It had started out as a notion about urban-rural differences, which I much later worked into the book on Pillars of the Republic. But when I tried to do it for a dissertation, which Balin thought was fine, I thought I would take four communities in New York State, New York City, and maybe Dutchess County, maybe someplace around Schenectady where I grew up, which is a wonderful old Dutch town, and maybe someplace, I don't know, some small place. I would go up to Albany to the archives and see what kind of records I can find. And without belaboring the point, the records were so thin for New York, I was just afraid that most of the questions I was interested in wouldn't emerge as very, you know, doable. And so my book became a book about New York by default. It became the part that was researchable, which may sound kind of a modest way to do a dissertation. Balin kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, yeah, well, you do what you can. You know? So as I got into it, I found that it became a piece of urban history, but it hadn't started that way. It was going to be a piece of comparative community history. And only much later in my career was I able to try to pull that off in a book that gave me the latitude to range across the whole country for sources. So I did this book on New York City, and the innovative thing about it was that it used a new periodization. It went way back to 1750 to try and look at a system that was prior to the public school system and look at the way people in cities developed education, first through charity schools and a lot through cheap private schools, and how those evolved into a public school system. So it was very different than the old-fashioned traditional school history that we call Whigger school history, and that it wasn't at all a defense of the public system. It was different, I haven't thought about how to characterize this in a long time, it was different from the radical revisionism in that it didn't see the public schools as particularly as a plot, although they certainly were dominated by elite people and mostly Protestant people, and there were huge debates between the Protestants and the Catholics. But I think mine was a middle ground where I pointed out that there was a certain logic to a lot of people, including a lot of people that had been running church schools and so forth, to just turn over their schools to the government. A lot of people got involved in the development of bureaucracy, and at the front end of it, it didn't look like such a bad thing as it did later on. So that was the middle ground in that dissertation.
That became a book eventually.
That became a book.
Common school.
Yeah, I have. So one lasting regret about that book was that I titled it, not for the dissertation, but for the manuscript that went into the press, I titled it The Perfect System. And it was a quote from some guy in New York City who said, when we finally get the public high school in here, we'll then have the keystone of the arch, the perfect system. Mm-hmm. And I thought it a great metaphor for mm-hmm. this creation of a school system by 1850. So a reader, who I later learned was Marvin Lazarson, but the anonymous reader for Harvard said, terrible title, get rid of it. So I was well behaved, and so the press said, get rid of your title, and so I worked and worked and couldn't find a good title, and it finally wound up being this boring dissertation sounding thing called The Origins of an Urban School System. And next year, after mine was published, David Tyack's book, The One Best System, appeared.
That's right.
And if I had published The Perfect System the year before with Harvard, Harvard never would have published his with the title The One Best System. And The One Best System has come to be synonymous with Tyack and with the truth about public schools as they came to represent a notion that there was only one system. His title actually is about a slightly different theme than mine. The One Best System refers to the idea that there's only one good way to do things in a school system. It's not just the flow chart and having all the pyramid and the keystone of the arch in place. So I'm not trying to steal any thunder from David, but when I told him this story about 5 years ago, he was astounded that his title had been saved by this anonymous reader who didn't like it for some reason or another.
Well, so there was the English teacher in you with the perfect system. That's a nice kind of English type ring to it. Okay, you came here. What made you? Obviously, you came to Madison because there was a job available here. Were there any other offers, and why did you select Madison?
It's just, I was going to say fell in my lap. It didn't fall in my lap. I think it was the old-fashioned system of being, protege of a prominent person. I believe, I'm not sure about this, but I believe that I know the job was open the year before, and that there were people who interviewed for it, and I know that one who interviewed for it was this man who I later came to know pretty well, Marvin Lazarson, who was at Harvard. I believe he got an offer and turned it down. I'm not certain of that, but I think he did. That's what I heard a long time ago. So I benefited, in a way, from Marvin deciding he wanted to cast his fate with Harvard, where he was an assistant professor, and although he knew he probably wouldn't get tenure there, since they rarely tenure from the ranks, he was having a great deal of fun being a housemaster. Assistant housemaster under Jerome Bruner, and he thought that was very exciting. And they had just integrated the Radcliffe dorms into the Harvard dorm system, and they were co-ed and all this stuff. So he wanted to stay there and do that. So that left this job open. It was a job here that had originally been the position of Merle Borman, the founder of the department and the chair. So it was vacant for a year because that search had fallen through, and then the following fall they started again. How I found out about it was this old-fashioned and as elitist as the academic system can be. Balin called me into his office, said, they've asked me about this job at Wisconsin. I think you should go interview for it. I said, okay, what do I do? He said, well, just write this man here. So I went and I interviewed. I was signed up at the Harvard Placement Bureau for education or U.S. history, and I just don't remember anything that was in my field that was remotely competitive with this job. I was tremendously lucky to come along at the right time and have this prominent advisor. I don't know who else interviewed for the job. I really don't know. A number of people interviewed the year before. I don't know if a bunch of them interviewed again the year I was a candidate. I've never heard. So most people these days know about the search that they're part of, but I just know that I came here and interviewed with only one chapter of my dissertation done and was put through quite a grilling about the dissertation, all the usual appropriate things, and got a job offer a month or so later. So it was dandy with me. I used to joke, but I don't know if it's actually accurate, that the next best job I heard of was in the night school at Rutgers. But if that isn't literally true, it was virtually true. It was not as if there were other good things to do and that I heard about them or that I applied elsewhere. So off I came. I didn't, as the old cliche goes, actually I know a little more geography than some people, so I knew where Wisconsin was, but I'd certainly never been in it, and I knew nothing about it.
Did you know anything about the history of Ed? Department here, or history of ed field here?
No, I didn't. I didn't know much. I had known of Jürgen Herbst, but hadn't read his stuff. I didn't know the other people. I knew that the university in general was one of the best in the Big Ten, and so I wasn't making any mistake in that regard. But I didn't know much about the Ed School. I enjoyed the visit I had a lot. I thought that was great.
Let's talk about your first years here. What about the other people in the history of ed field? Actually, almost the entire Department of Educational Policy Studies at that time had at least one foot in history, did they not?
Well, it has been the biggest discipline in the Department of Educational Policy Studies, as I quipped the other day at that farewell party. It was a well-balanced department, two sociologists, two philosophers, six historians. There were just a lot of people because we had this area called comparative education, but it includes two historians. And later came along Michael Olnick, who's a very good sociologist and quite a good quantitative methods person, but he was an undergraduate history major at Columbia and is now doing work that's quite historical on American pluralism. So there were lots of people doing history, and some of them came over from curriculum and instruction. Ed Krug was in the department at the time. Mike, was he jointly appointed? He was your professor.
I don't think so.
Maybe
I
he was just
he was
EPS.
Just EPS, yeah.
But there were people that were wonderful, well-known historians who were denying that they were historians. Like, well, I'm not really a historian. Like Ed Krug used to say, I'm not really a historian. Well, there he was, the definitive historian of the American high school. And Klebart has often had the same kind of modest thing because they didn't go to formal training programs in U.S. history or even in history of education. But there were all these people doing history. That was wonderful. When I met, I don't know exactly how soon it started, but it was certainly during the first year I was here. Ed Krug had his office over on University Avenue, away from the main home of the department, because already his heart was giving him trouble, what eventually killed him. And I think that was the first year I was here that was the case. I may have mixed this up a little bit, but the essence of the story is still that there were these virtual pilgrimages. Mike Apple was a brand new assistant professor, and so was I, and Klebar decided that we would enjoy Krug, and the four of us would eat together at the Ivy Inn, no great culinary establishment. But you could go over there, you know, and get tuna salad on white or whatever, and we would have these long talks with Ed, and that was where I got to know him. The days were gone when he would hold court at Tripp Commons, and there were some great stories earlier than I was here, but my introduction to him was this foursome, usually the four of us. I don't know how that started or why it didn't involve Jürgen. I don't know, I should say a word about Ed Krug. He is such a gentle man and so encyclopedic in his knowledge of this stuff. He loved the factual basis of his history, and he was always modest about his interpretive abilities. But then we all decided that, of course, he was the one who trained this Joel Spring, the radical revisionist. And if you read his books carefully, you would find these important themes in there about social efficiency being one face of progressivism and social service being another face. So that was an original way to chop up the material and to interpret what was going on. But Ed was a sweet, sweet man, and it was kind of a worship fest we went through with him.
I remember one time I was with Herb Klebart out in the hall, and we were trying to remember whether this 19th century historian or educator, maybe it was Horace Mann or someone, whether he had a beard or mutton chops or whatever. And Krug just happened to come walking by, and we asked him, and he proceeded to give us a 45-minute lecture on the history of facial hair in America. it is, as you can imagine, his own modest, unassuming way.
Yeah, he was a nice guy. I was glad when I was chair of the department much later, and after Ed died, two things happened. One is we had a Krug recognition that was wedded to the 30th anniversary of the school. For some reason, the dean's office decided that it was time to celebrate because, I mean, who would have celebrated the 30th anniversary of the school? Am I right? Maybe it was the 50th. That would make more sense. I think it was the 30th. And it was long after UW had programs in education. It just must have been when they formalized the name School of Education.
So or whatever it could it was. Be when they broke off from L&S.
Yeah, whatever. So we had this occasion. It was some anniversary of the school. And they wanted each department to find ways to celebrate it. So one of the ways we celebrated it was by having an Edward Krug lecture, which we invited Dave Tyack to do, and he came, and that was nice. But more importantly, we dedicated this Edward Krug Lounge in EPS and got some money to make it a nice place. So it's a bit of a shrine for those of us who knew Ed, but it's really a nice place to have in the life of the department. A very attractive lounge, and Herb Klebart has put in these wonderful photographs that he got from the State Historical Society of Kids at School. The other historians, Sterling Fishman and Jürgen Herbst, I just had a very good introduction. For one thing, when you come as an assistant professor, you're supposed to be worried about tenure. Nobody ever here gave me a feeling that I was going to have to worry about tenure. And that was long before I had the goods. I mean, I had a dissertation and one really obscure article in print. I just got the feeling that they felt they had chosen me, therefore they expected me to succeed. And I was used to that attitude. That was the much vaunted attitude at Yale and other Ivy League institutions. It's hard to get in and it's hard to get out. Mm-hmm. You know, we expect you to finish. It's not a competitive situation. I found that true. There's another little sidelight that I think is relevant. There had been a flurry of activity when I was in my second year of graduate school, that is the end of my first year at Harvard. And Jonathan Messerly had not been kept on at Teachers College as Lawrence Kremen's younger colleague. And that was a controversial case I won't go into. But anyway, he was dropped. And so they were looking for a junior historian of education. My name came up. And I hemmed and hawed. I thought, heck, I haven't even got my dissertation hardly begun. And I've got this 3-year fellowship at Harvard. How could I do this? It's wacko. It's premature. But they said, send down a vita. So I sent down a vita. And never got any further than that. And the person who eventually got it was a fellow graduate school mate of mine who I liked a lot, named Douglas Sloan, who was made a nice junior colleague to Larry Kremen and is still at Teachers College. My then wife said, you know, you're really lucky they thought it was too early for you. You know, because she said, to be the junior colleague of Lawrence Kremen would be really hard. Because I wound up being an interpreter of a quite broad swath of American educational history. And I think a lot of things could have happened. One of is it's possible that being in the shadow of Larry Kremen could have spoiled my appreciation for him, because I don't know if I would have had the kind of room to grow that I needed, or whether I would have inappropriately resented his prominence. But I think to be in kind of closely in contact in the junior colleague of a person who's set out to be the master interpreter of American education and is winning Pulitzer Prizes in his attempts to do that could have been really problematic. And the relevance that has to here is that this was the opposite. This was utterly different. Herbst and Fishman just considered me as an equal colleague from the minute I got here. They were helpful enough and they were willing to tell me stuff, but the idea that there was some kind of dominant force in the department that was going to shape other people was completely absent. And Herbst was always good about, just being happy when I succeeded and being a good friend when I needed help. So he was a good, relaxed colleague. And we complemented each other well because his institutional history of higher education is on different turf than mine, and his intellectual world is more informed by philosophy and intellectual history, and mine's more informed, I guess, by notions of system and economics and social class. So that really worked well. What else?
Well, what about Bob Kahle and Herb Clebard. You want to talk about them? Bob is, he's a cross-listed history person, right?
Yeah. Bob Carroll's an interesting phenomenon. He's really been wonderful for EPS. When I got here, the history department was all tied up in factions around two issues. It's close to a subject we're supposed to talk later on, but it's relevant to Bob Carroll.
Let's do it now.
The history department had suffered a lot in the Great War, the Vietnam War. And at the same time, as you know, UW went through the unionization of its teaching assistance force. And both of these, both the Vietnam War and the Teaching Assistance Association, were very, very divisive in the history department. It was a much more political department, and it had polar opposites much more than Ed Policy Studies did. Ed Policy Studies tended to be middle of the road. Not everybody was exactly in the same place, but I would say it was middle of the road for Wisconsin, which was liberal, left of center. Nobody very radical, nobody horrendously conservative. The history department had people who, on both the issues of the war, and especially those issues of the war that related to universities, whether you would put up with disruption, how much disruption you would put up with, what was defensible in terms of disrupting the university in the service of stopping the war, all that kind of stuff. And of course, this campus had been through the Sterling Hall bombing and so forth. So they were real enemies that had been made over this. They were real factions. And Bob was a teacher of German history and had participated both in pro-TA activities and anti-war stuff. So that didn't make him very popular. And he hadn't published anything hardly at all. His dissertation hadn't gotten into a book and so forth. So he was not very well appreciated. In fact, I think he felt really, you know, quite put upon in the history department. And at some point, he had developed this interest in EPS before I came here that had nothing to do with his German history. Unlike Sterling and Jürgen and I, who had a joint appointment which simply symbolized that we did history of education in both departments, Bob did modern German history, not to do with education in the history department, and he did African universities and comparative education in EPS. And we paid him, what, a third of his salary, something like that. He had worked this out as a kind of a haven from his frustration at never being able to succeed in the history department. He had this other intellectual interest. He just started like a beachhead in EPS. So by the time I got there, he was a member of EPS, and I wouldn't have ever guessed that he was only a one-third member because he was just pouring a lot of effort and expertise.
I always saw
him
in his office. He was right next door to you for many
years. Yeah,
or still is, I guess.
He's a good guy. He went through some hard times in the 1950s and personal difficulties. He came out in his 60s just being as smart as he could be. He's never published a great deal, but he did make it back on his feet in the history department. He finished the book that had been, I think, his dissertation on the SS, and got it published, and it got a good review. It actually got reviewed along with some others, but nonetheless got reviewed in the New York Review of Books, and positively, and he got a nice raise out of it. I don't think I'm telling stories out of school there. And so he had kind of a resurrection in the history department for his expertise that had been there all along on German history. But he's always been a bargain for EPS because he moved from this interest in African universities to knowing all the theories about colonialism, and he became the person to whom all our Asian students went. And, you know, we've been quite thin in comparative education, and Casamias has been oriented mostly toward Western Europe. So Bob was our third world, and all for us paying one third of his salary. He's been our summer chair a number of times. He's a nice guy. Never became a star outside this university. There are a lot of people like him, you know, that they've had fallow periods and productive periods, but it didn't add up to a big portfolio where they were widely known outside of Wisconsin. And Bob is like 73 now, and he's not retired
still
yet.
Still going strong,
I think he's going to retire soon. But
you've talked a bit earlier about the nice atmosphere that there was in EPS, you know, the collegial atmosphere and not having to prove yourself. Since we're in the history department for a moment now, was that an issue with you in history? Did you have that same feeling, or?
Well,
was it a different?
It's so big that you can make seven or eight friends, you know, and that's like as many people as there are in EPS. Yeah. I mean, there are about a dozen people hang their hat in EPS. So small departments are wonderful when they're collegial and get along well together, but any problems you have are tougher in a small department. Yeah. There are two ways they're tougher. It's a little hard to escape people, and I had a much vaunted sort of conflict of personalities with one member of our department. It's no great secret with Andy Casamias. And so we just sort of existed in separate tracks within EPS. But that's harder than it is in a big department like history. In history, you don't like somebody, you just ignore them. They had 55 members for most of the time I was here. something in that neighborhood, of whom over 20 were Americanists, 23, 24. So I made soon six or seven good friends, saw them socially, saw them around the campus, people I liked a lot, very different people, John Cooper and Dick Sewell and Tom McCormick and quite a range of people. The culture of the department was much tougher. It was much more confrontational. There were factions and so forth. People remembered, a lot of this stuff came out of the 60s, and a lot of this stuff, but I've heard stories in the history department about, well, you don't know this, you only came in 1970. Somebody might tell you that in 1985. They would say, if you only came in 1970, you don't understand that Professor X overheard Professor Y make an anti-Semitic remark back in the early 60s, you know, and has never forgiven him.
Long memory,
that
long
kind of
eyes.
Stuff. So, and there were these three groups based on geographical areas, the U.S. and the European and the Third World, and so that made for an era of contention, competing for spots and slots and who was doing the most for the department and so forth. But I think the ideological variation in the history department is just wider, and personalities and so forth. So, what to say? Not only did this stuff not bother me so much, I think it would have bothered me more if it was my main home, mm-hmm. because not only was it more contentious, kind of fussy place with some real prima donnas, but also it's in a building that's really ugly, and that kind of propels people out into various cubby holes in libraries or, you know, local pubs or whatever, but they don't hang around the humanities department much. And so for a long time I was here, there was a certain air of being an unpleasant place because some personalities were tough and because it wasn't a very nice place to be. That has a real impact, I think, on students. It has a morale factor on some faculty, either the kind that are there all the time and are involved in some conflict that they can't get past, or in that big a department, there's a much greater stratification of reward structure, so there's kind of haves and have-nots in terms of chaired professors and resources and things. So there got to be a contingent of people who were relatively unhappy with the department. That didn't affect me so much, and in fact, sometimes I was called in because people found out that I run committees relatively well, you know, that I do my homework and I'm generally temperate and I didn't have as much at stake, so they considered me kind of an outsider, so they would sometimes ask me to be on things because they thought I could adjudicate them well. Now, I'm not trying to be heroic about it. I didn't do a lot of that. In my early days, I did more committee work in history than my budget line ever would have justified, because I felt you can't be in a department and not be a citizen of the department. But the most infamous example of this, which kind of drove me away from doing this kind of stuff, was on a promotion committee about this.